Awareness, the final frontier. These are the explorations of Jonathan Robinson and Brian Tom O'Connor. Their continuing mission, to discover fresh new paths to the mystery within, to seek out new joys and new methods of awakening, to boldly go into the heart of expanded consciousness. This is Awareness Explorers.
Well, welcome, fellow explorers. I am here with a very exciting guest, Rick Weinman, and of course, my co-host, Brian Tom O'Connor. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm doing very well, Jonathan. I'm really looking forward to this episode.
Me too, because I've been steeping myself in all things Rick Weinman. He's written a couple of books, Awakening Through the Veils and Vortex Healing, A Magical Path. And he's also the head of the Vortex Healing, I don't know if I'd call it a movement, or the Consciousness Healing Method. And if you want to know more about Rick and his work, Vortex Healing and other things, you can go to vortexhealing.org and find out everything about that. We will mostly be talking about his awakening approaches and what he knows about awareness, which is just an amazing amount of information as I've been working and reading his books. And I know Brian has also been doing that. So we're glad that we get to interrogate him here today and have some fun with him. And I want to welcome you, Rick, to Awareness Explorers.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, you know, there's so much in your books and so much in the stuff that you teach about vortex healing on awakening. So before we dive into some of that, I guess I'd like to ask how you define basic awakening, because that's going to be helpful in discussing more granular topics about awakening as we get into it. So how would you define basic awakening?
Well, I think I'd have to take two steps back to create a bigger picture. Awakening applies to us as incarnational beings. You know, we accumulate these issues and over eons, we start to lose them. And Earth is sort of a graduation plan. So we come here eventually to lose them. Those issues appear in the system, and they're carried by the incarnational body and the incarnational personality. And then they appear in the body as what I call karmanas, which are these little focal points of separation consciousness that sit vertically in the spine, in the core of the spine. And in the center of these karmanas is just pure separation consciousness. And then around each one is like the consciousness of some particular issue based on that separation. So at some point, we move through all those karmanas, and that creates a certain inner freedom. It's not awakening yet, and yet it's a new level of freedom because we move through kind of the root of these karmic issues. So in order for any karmana to move, the core of the issue, which is pure separation consciousness, it's not like a thorn that can be pulled out. It needs to be awakened by something that isn't in separation consciousness. So each karmana is almost like a little mini awakening in its own right. Now, then you've got this whole line of karmanas that's been awakened, and it creates this kind of not quite awakening yet, but this awakeness in the system that starts to move deeper. And we have a map for how that works, but at some point it creates this hole in what I call the core veil. And the core veil is this consciousness structure that on a human level, on an incarnational level, actually it's brought in incarnationally, holds the sense of I and the heart. The heart is the center of all identity. And there are deeper levels of this identity as well, this I identity. But on the incarnational level, there is this consciousness structure that forms. And consciousness is all about reflection and memory, right? That's how consciousness remembers things. It reflects back and forth, I. In every moment, you literally maintain your sense of individual egoic self through remembering it. You keep reflecting back and forth in your mind, you know, I, and, and you'll remember all your history and I this and I that. And so it's this continuous movement. Like Adi Shanti at one point called ego movement. And that's what he's referring to. It's because it's this continuous movement of I back and forth, remembering itself. And it sort of weaves its story of itself in every moment as it continuously goes forward, remembering itself.
How does that change when one awakens?
Okay, so with awakening, what happens is that enough stillness is brought to that core place where the consciousness is reflecting the sense of I, that it just stops.
Mm-hmm.
And then that reflection, that whole main, and this will only happen if it's ripe. If someone isn't really ripe for awakening, like if they still have karma knots, they can't awaken. They may have a moment taste of some non-I kind of experience. But what happens if they're ripe is when that stops, it just goes right through. And that whole structure just breaks down. It's kind of like I don't like the word illusion, because until it breaks down, it's a real phenomenon, right? It's, mm-hmm. you know, there's nothing ultimately inside of it, but while it's happening, I mean, while you're watching a movie, it's, you know, it's a real movie, right? And then suddenly the projector turns off and, you know, it's this whole other reality that opens. My favorite line about awakening, though, about this first level of awakening, is that everything changes and nothing changes. And that, of course, confusing as it sounds, is much more confusing experientially.
I so, can imagine.
So, you know, on the one hand, you know, like for myself when that happened, you know, on the one hand, all the mental conditioning and emotional conditioning was still there, but it was like this bubble around me. It was still going on, yet my relationship, it was no longer what I was. And so my relationship to all of it changed. So everything changed because my relationship to it all changed, even though it was still the same.
So you were not identified with it, although it was still happening.
Right, right. And in the center of all that was this place of just nice beingness that had never been there before. Right? It was this place that I called the no-I zone in the heart where the... So, for instance, the way that I see if someone has had basic awakening is I look at their mind stuff, which is all I, this, you know, it's all that I thinking. And I look to see if it goes down and is rooted in the heart. Right? Because as long as there's what I call a core veil, which is holding all that in place as a core incarnational identity of I, all that I thinking will all be rooted in the heart. And if someone loses that core veil, it's all just happening in the head as this sort of leftover weather, but nothing goes to the heart. So mm-hmm. so for me, that's what happens at basic awakening. And so it's very, you know, kind of scientific in that sense. You know, there's a specific thing to look for, and either it's there or it isn't. Now, that doesn't mean a person's going to be behaving in any more enlightened kind of way, you know, because all the conditioning is still there. And we've all heard of all kinds of, you know, wake teachers that have behaved, you know, in very poor manner. Well, I think it was maybe the first Zen master who came, you know, brought it to America. Later it was found out that he was, you know, sexually abusing all of his students. And, you know, you get stories like that. Suzanne Segal had this, when she woke up, great book called Collision with the Infinite. When mm-hmm. she woke up, this terror arose in her system. And throughout, as she kept evolving in her awakening, she used to say that her awakening didn't touch the terror, and the terror didn't impact her awakening. They were happening like in two separate places. They were like two realities, although I believe towards the end of her life, she started to integrate. But that integration is sort of the what we call the embodiment process. It's where, you know, you start to clean up that conditioning, which is much easier to do when one's awake mm-hmm. than when one isn't awake, because there's a freedom which gives you leverage in a sense, right? You start to be able to break down identities in a different kind of a way. So as that starts to break down and one becomes less and less identified with just the habits of the conditioning, then one naturally, without trying to, starts to live more from awakeness. But that's an embodiment process that has nothing to do with the awakening itself.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I find fascinating about your system, and just full information, I have started taking some classes in Vortex Healing, which Rick is the founder of, is that it's very scientific and precise. I mean, like, you know, a lot of teachers about awakening, they say, well, meditate and you just wake up, or you don't, or whatever. Whereas you have hundreds of distinctions, which are both fascinating and interesting. I'm wondering, you know, when it comes to these things, like, most of our audience won't know these things, but, you know, karmic knots or different dimensions of reality, core veils, different types of awakening, etc. It's all very precise. How do you get this information, or how did this information come to you?
First of all, I'll just say it's less complicated than it seems. Mm-hmm. We have what I call an eye tree, and we have a map of different dimensions. But essentially, it's just that from the first beginning of the sense of eye, you know, that it sort of grows down through the dimensions and eventually becomes this core veil, which is this core sense of eye and the incarnational personality, which becomes our human sense of eye, which sort of marries the, you know, the kind of ancestral egoic history that's, you know, that makes up the body. So for me, in my own process, the source of our lineage, which was the avataric being Merlin, was actually born as Mahindra some 5,600 years ago. I won't get into all the history, it's on the website. Anyway, it's an avataric being, which means it's a divine expression, not really a being. And that's what powers this lineage and is my guide through my process. And Merlin has taken me through my own awakening one little step at a time, so that at each step I can sort of understand, interpret, you know, what's happening and draw a map of it. And that was the plan from the beginning, was that, so although, you know, I'm considered a teacher, or I'm teaching classes, I don't really feel like a teacher. I feel like I'm just a guide. Merlin has taken me down a certain path, and I'm just guiding people down the path that's been shown to me to take people down. So I feel like this step-by-step has been shown to me because we're not doing it in a vague way. We want to be able to take people step-by-step as a group, you know, to take a whole group, get them to the place where they're all ripe for awakening, wake them up, and then as a group, move them to the next step, which if we don't have a map of step-by-step, then we can't do that. So this way, we can take people, and again, this has nothing to do with embodiment. This is just the deepening of literally going up that eye tree, you know, to the source. So that's how, you know, that detail sort of arose for me. And, you know, I just have the right resume for being able to both sense it and be able to put it into words. Mm-hmm.
I have lots of questions. I want to ask you, Brian, what strikes you, or what are you curious about?
Thanks, Jonathan. Actually, I'd love to circle back to something that you said earlier about the sense of I being in the heart. And in your book, Awakening Through the Veils, you say that this basic sense of I actually centers in the area of your heart, in the center of your chest. You say it's not your physical heart, it's the center of your chest. And when I look for the sense of I don't actually experience it inside my body. I experience my body as inside my sense of I. So I was wondering, is this just semantics, or am I missing something in my chest and that I'm not seeing? And if so, maybe do you have any advice or help to actually sense that?
Well, if I find it, I can mail it to you.
Okay. How much is it?
So some people, you know, create identity. They sort of construct their self image, you might say, in different ways. And some people will create more identity with their field, you know, than they do with, you know, sort of inner, their inner being in a certain way. And so what you're describing to me looks like where you've created this sort of identity with your field. Yet if you were to see that not as I, but as what you're identifying I with, and then look to see what's identifying with that. Yeah, right there, I'm just tracking the video. Right there, you start to touch on something that's in your heart.
For our listeners, he's nodding his head.
I was looking and not trying to come up with words. I was looking to see what I noticed. And I see what you mean. It's like the larger eye that's looking at my body is also a sense of identification or a concept or a story. And you asked, what is it that has identified with that? And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not talking about a larger sense of I. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about, well, more of the center of where your experience is actually being rooted from. So, for instance, you know, I spent a lot of years out of my body, and my own identity would have been felt more, you know, out there in a particular way than in here, even though it was still actually rooted in here. I would have, whatever that root was, I would have use that to experience myself as out there. Mm-hmm.
And when you said you were tracking the video, so you were looking for something on the video?
I was just watching what your consciousness was doing.
When, what was it doing, and how could you tell?
Well, because I can see consciousness. So I saw it move from, you know, out there where you had been experiencing I saw it starting to move inside, and then I saw it start to resonate with that whole kind of mind-heart feedback loop.
I see. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things we try to do with Awareness Explorers is really give people practical tools for getting to their next step. And, of course, most of our listeners are not very familiar with vortex healing. So I'm wondering, just in a general way, if you have any tools that you can give people for practicing in daily life that you think are useful for awakening.
Sure. So a lot of the listeners, of course, will still have karma knots. And for any level of awakening, including karma knots, what you're dealing with is essentially separation consciousness, ego or egoic consciousness is consciousness that's experiencing itself as something that is separate from everything else. So it needs something that's awake that isn't in that to wake it up. It's like, you know, if your friend is sleeping on the couch and you're not, you know, you can go over and wake him up because you're already awake. So it needs something that's awake to wake that up. So in general, hanging out with, you know, awake teachers, hanging out with avatars who are not karmic humans, but are divine expressions that have incarnated into human form, you know, beings like Amma, you know, the hugging saint who travels all over, and but also, you know, ones that aren't no longer, that are no longer alive, Jesus, Neem Karoli Baba, Krishna, you know, these are all beings that although they seem not to be here, the moment you reach out to them, they're here. And, you know, I had, just to share a quick story, I had broken my clavicle years ago, and when they went to fix it, instead of butting the ends together, they overlapped it and just tied it because that was easier. And for some years, I didn't understand why I didn't have any room there. Finally, a chiropractor told me that the collarbone was, on one side, was like, you know, quite a bit shorter than on the other side. I went home and measured it with a string, and it was literally 3/4 inch shorter, which on a bone that's only, you know, that big is a lot. And So at the time I was working with Ngen Krolyi Baba inside, who was Ram Dass's guru and miracle master, so to speak. And he did all these miracles while he was alive. Miracle of Love, this lovely book that talks about them. And so I asked him if I should get one of these bone breaking operations where they break the bone and then they slowly regrow it. And he said, no, he would make it grow. And he was no longer alive when I asked him. So I, as much as I had faith in him, you know, I had this prejudice against, like, you know, dead avatars. And 2 weeks later, they were the same size. It was just unbelievable. I went back to the same chiropractor, sort of blew his mind. Because, you know, he knew his bones. He knew how much shorter it looked when he'd seen it last time. So one can meditate into these beings. One can use their pictures, you know, meditating into the, you know, their photographs, you know, and you just, you feel wherever you feel separate. There are different ways to do that. You can feel in your spine, which is where the karma knots are. You can feel kind of like the core of your spine sort of opening to them. Or you can feel your heart opening to their love, or you can feel yourself just relaxing, merging with their presence. Different people have different ways to work with it. It doesn't require anything devotional per se. It's just, you know, you're looking at, let's say, a picture of Ngen Krolyi Baba or Amma, and the mind is basically saying, you know, what's there? You know, but you can't really know what's there from your mind. You have to feel it with your heart. You have to feel what's there. And so, you know, as you're more and more willing to feel what's there, you know, it enters into you. Or conversely, what's already inside of you, which is the same thing, you know, moves to the surface. Either way, it starts to open. You start to bang up against the things that are in the way of that. And that's pure love. That's pure beingness. That's pure awakeness. And so anything that can't open to it is basically something that's ego, that's stuck, that's blocked. And as you just sit with it and just keep sitting with that presence, you know, it starts to move. That's the easiest way I know in general to, you know, kind of direct people towards that. The other traditional way, of course, is just going after one's own identity. So it's going inside and going, okay, what is this sense of I? You know, what is this? You know, and you explore it, kind of going to the root of it. It's sort of like tracking something to its lair. Okay, where does this start? Where is its root? What is it in its essential core? And as you go deeper and deeper, your own awareness inside of that starts to waken up. Because ultimately your awareness is not different from awake awareness that is the thing you're looking for.
One of the things I like about your approach is it really has I call it the two wings of an airplane. You know, one wing is what you just talked about of noticing who am I, so to speak, you know, noticing where your identity is identified. And the other is this whole energetic approach, which I haven't found hardly any other systems that deal with both approaches at once. So I'm wondering how you see these approaches of what could be called consciousness or identity or awareness work and energetic work working together.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And part of it has to do with the fact that well, there are two reasons, actually. One is that our goal is to create awakening for people. We want to be able to do it on a group level. Taking an individual and, let's say, meditating with just an individual, it's a different story than when you're trying to create a movement in consciousness in a whole group, right? And so you need to evolve the energetics of that group to be able to actually move the group as a whole. Right. In addition, awakening itself, there's a certain energetic component that supports it and makes it easier to stay in there in the sense of awakening. And that's another component of it, is that energetic is going to end up supporting the awakening. And the third aspect of it is that we're also a healing art. And we want to be able to give people the tools, not just to, we want to do more than awaken them. We want to give them healing tools, both because we're into healing, but also because those tools, once they're awake, are going to also help them to move through that conditioning that keeps wanting to pull them out of their awakeness. So they go together hand in hand. And one of the first people who I facilitated awakening with really showed me the value of both. So I could feel this person was right for awakening. I started to work with her. And then we hit this wall. And the wall was some kind of fear she had. And so it stopped. And I did some work with her to move that wall. And then we were going deeper again. And then we hit another wall, which was just a deeper layer of the fear. So here you can see how conditioning is getting in the way of her awakening. And so that night she did a lot of work on that fear and came back the next morning. And then we were able to go through and, you know, move through a core veil. So, you know, so you can see even before awakening, you know, how that works. In addition, the tools that people get as healing tools, they are then able to help other people's process, you know, to move their karma knots and facilitate their spiritual growth, as well as, you know, just to do normal kinds of healing on. But for us, the two go hand in hand. And one actual other aspect of it is that once a person is awake, we can give them a different level of healing tool, because their whole energy system moves to another level. And then as we're giving people that next level of healing tool, the transmissions for that create a certain energetic evolution in their system that then enables me to take them as a group and move them into the next level of awakening. So you can see how it all starts to kind of work together for us anyway, to be able to take a group, you know, to the levels of awakening that we're taking them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When you described earlier the process of looking inside, it was almost a self-inquiry process as to where that sense of self arises from. That did seem very simple, and that did seem very direct, and I resonated with it as you spoke. But I was wondering if there are other resistances. For example, you mentioned earlier that you had a prejudice against, dead avatars, and I am skeptical as well. And is that a resistance that needs to be worked through, or can one use, like me, what I resonate with, which is the sort of direct inquiry into the nature of self?
Well, on the one hand, it was sort of stupid of me to have the prejudice I had, because I already had such amazing experiences with Neem Karoli Baba, who was no longer alive from the time I started having experiences with him. It was just because it was such a physical thing. You know, we're talking about a bone, right? You know, but he could do anything while he was alive. And so direct inquiry works for some people. It's easy to get kind of caught in the head with it, is the danger. And easy as well to get into a particular kind of feeling sense of self, and that you're not really getting deeper then, and you think, okay, this must be it. Right? So if one is doing that, it's good to do it, you know, to still be working with a teacher who's awake. So you've got some kind of mirror there. And I used to say that it was very good. I had both avataric teachers and, you know, incarnational human teachers. So with someone like Amma and Neem Karoli Baba, if you look at their photo, they were never really in separation. You know, they've always been, because they're divine expressions. So your humanist, there's the love that's there that is easy to feel, but in terms of tracking, let's say, the patterning of your consciousness and seeing how that aligns with there's no patterning there in that way. Whereas when I would work with Papaji or back then with Aja, you could feel the construct of human psyche and how awakening sat in that. And then, you know, it sort of taught me other things that I couldn't learn from just working with an avatar. And so for some people, they might be able to just do self-inquiry and wake up from that, but it's hard. And for other people, it might just, Papaji used to say, for a very limited number of people, it's like a shortcut. But I think he was talking about people who are really already right. And all they needed was this extra little something to sort of, you know, like Papaji used to, I saw Papaji in person, and he would do things that would stop my mind, and there would be this, you know, actually just from reading his book. But see, I wasn't ripe at the time, so I'd get the, but, you know, wouldn't wake up, you know. You know, there'd be a moment of something, you know, trying to break through, but it you know, there's too much in the way. And I ended up getting into my first full samadhi working with his book. And, you know, because I had nothing to compare it to, you know, I thought that was it. You know, I thought I got into heaven and fell out. You know, I thought, well, I'll get back in. It took me a month to get back in. Second samadhi fell right back out. Now I was depressed because I thought that was it. And I had no idea how to stay there. Right. So mm-hmm. I went all the way to India to ask him, how do I stay there? And he said, where do you think you went? And I said, well, it's a perfect bliss. You know, he said, well, for every going, there's a return.
Right. That was very wise of him.
And I wasn't really ready to get it yet. But anyway, it's hard to do it on one's own through self-inquiry. There's just too many traps. So, you know, and in terms of, you know, skepticism, you know, if you're looking at a picture of like Nkrumah Baba or Alma and you're feeling love, you're feeling what's there, there's really nothing to be skeptical about because you're just feeling what you're feeling, right? You know, it's not, you don't have to analyze, you know, who are they really and, you know, what does this mean? You know, you just feel it, right? Bypasses all the mind stuff and the skepticism.
Yeah.
And you can do both. It's not an either or. You know, you can do inquiry and you can, you know, you can work with, you know, a photo like that. Mm-hmm.
I used to not believe in any of this stuff until I started to have so many experiences. I now tell people who ask me about vortex healing, I say, yeah, I don't believe in this stuff. It just seems to work. And that seems to be my experience. So I don't take my beliefs or thoughts about stuff as seriously as I used to.
Mm-hmm.
No. You know, in Awakening Through the Veils, one of your books, you talk about different types of awakening or different levels, mm-hmm. such as finding awake space in the heart versus, say, open stillness in the heart. And I'm wondering if you think it would be useful, if there's anything useful to say about these different levels of awakening and maybe how one can understand them or move in that direction.
Well, awake space in the heart, awake stillness in the heart. For me, those aren't really terms I use to define different levels of awakening. For us, it's this eye tree
mm-hmm.
that starts with the first localized sense of eye, and there's stages before it. It's like there's this whole intention of divinity to create this reality that we're living in. And so, you know, from nothing, it has to, first there's awareness, and awareness is sort of turned into consciousness the way water is turned into ice. And there's, you know, there are all these little steps there. And anyway, finally, in what we call the 10th dimension, there is this point of eye. You know, it's the beginning of the individual sense of I, and that gets densified down through the different dimensions into the 9th and the 8th. And there's this big focal point that's created in the 8th that we call the inner veil. And a lot of, when people talk about the word soul, they're either talking about their incarnational personality or they're talking about this focal point on the 8th dimensional level, which is what we will refer to as soul. But the soul isn't a being. The being is your incarnational being that goes from life to life. But to get there, it's like the I that's in that incarnational being has been grown kind of like the idea of growing something in a laboratory, except you're growing it through the dimensions and you're creating this focal point for it that's helping to support it, so that that sense of I will have this sense of deeper, it'll create the sense of deeper, it'll have the sense of deeper support. So it'll have the sense of a deeper sense of I, this higher self, if you will. Right? Mm-hmm. And usually what that's referring to is this focal point on the eighth dimension level. But all it is a focal point of I. It's higher self to us really means just a deeper sense of egoic I, you know, because as you get deeper up the I tree, that sense of self disappears. Like Ajahn once said, describing some different movements he had had, he said, I came across, there was one level where it was like this perfume of self in the field, the subtle perfume of self. And so, you know, so the sense of self is like that. And then at some point that dissolves, and then you go to look for this sense of self. It's just not there. Now you're still there. Whatever you are, you never disappear, because, you know, you ultimately are reality that's gotten identified through all these layers of egoic identity. But the sense of self is just itself another layer in that I tree. Mm-hmm. And then finally that sense of self gets dense, that sense of I becomes dense enough that it can sit inside of an incarnational body and create an incarnational personality around itself. And now you're off and running.
Yeah, it goes down from there. It goes downhill from there usually.
Go down, Moses. Experience the crown.
Brian, you have a question?
Yeah, I do. A lot of this description of the I tree and dimensions and levels of awakening, I'm wondering how we would... It seems like that creates an idea or a concept of something that we need to aspire to, something that we need to get, when it seems to me that it takes us away from the present moment and what's happening now. And how do we avoid that trap of thinking, well, just the way things are bad or wrong, and I need to advance up this tree or down this tree. I'm not quite sure which direction it goes. In other words, it's sort of like a complex
system. I understand. It's a good question.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a good question. And every path, you know, has its weakness, you might say. Mm-hmm. So the weakness for that is, just as you say, is that one can get too much into striving. At the same time, until we get to where we're actually in beingness, there's a sense of needing to go somewhere. Right? So, I mean, one can sit there and say there's nowhere to go. And I've done this, you know, before awakening, I'd be doing these meditations where I'm trying to convince myself there's nowhere to go while I'm sitting there trying to get to the place where there's nowhere to go.
It's a paradox.
And, and my sense is that one, it doesn't really become a reality until one is awakened to a certain point. And at that point, which doesn't have to be like the end of the road, but at some point, one has the experiential sense that, oh, you know, it's all here. You know, that there isn't anywhere to go. It's all here. And, you know, evolution is an unfolding is still going to happen. But whether it does or doesn't really doesn't make a difference, because there's nothing else but this, right? But it's different than when one is trying to start from that place. And what happens with a lot of different kinds of approaches is that the student of that approach creates a mental concept of however that should look, right? And then they try to live into that. And with Advaita, for instance, Neo-Advaita anyway, you see a lot of people who get really stuck in their heads, because Neo-Advaita is, you know, there's nowhere to go, nothing to do, there's no one to do it, you know, and so there isn't even a meditation that can be given, because, you know, that would be a doing of something for someone. And although there are people who can wake up through that, when I looked around at the audience, Neo-Advaita teachers, you see people who have created this sort of pseudo awakening in their head that isn't really awake. It's like, it's almost like a mental representation of what no one knowingness, you know, means. And then they think they've got it, but they're not awake. And
those people are especially annoying.
And they laugh at the Neo-Advaita jokes as if they've got it. And here's an interesting thing that happened in a class. So I had this one student who was very Neo-Advaita. She's very into Tony Parsons, who's a lovely being and very, very awake. He was a Neo-Advaita teacher in England. And she had been with him for some 20 years. And I would talk about, you know, awakening in class. And she would argue with me because there was nowhere to go and all this kind of stuff. But she wasn't awake. And one day I said, you know, let me just put this structure in your heart to facilitate your awakening. Let's just see what happens. And she said, okay. And I ran into her a month later and she'd woken up. And she knew she'd woken up and she had woken up. And so it was just very ironic because she'd been with this Neo-Advaita teacher for 20 years and hadn't woken up. But it gotten, I guess, close enough that I could put this energy structure in her heart to give her that extra whatever from a process point of view, which is, you know, exactly what Neo-Advaita is opposed to, is this whole idea of process. And then she woke up, you know, so it's just, to me, it's kind of a funny story.
Yeah.
So does that mean that she had ripened?
Yes.
And was ready?
Yeah, she had ripened because she'd been sitting with this awake being for 20 years. And I don't know that the particular philosophy had done her any good, but sitting with this being who was awake for 20 years, you know, got her to the place where she was ripe enough for, you know, some process type person like me to push her over the edge.
This might be our last question before we do a guided meditation. You know, I'm taking vortex healing classes and I am fascinated as a psychotherapist as to how you deal with issues or conditioning. You know, it's more as a therapist, you know, people talk about stuff and I've seen that that works incredibly slowly. In the vortex healing system, there's a combination of intention, connecting with a divine being or avatar, and say, asking for help with a certain issue. And I'm wondering, when one does that, what do you see happening? Do you have to be very precise with what you're asking, or does the divine being kind of, from your prayer or intention, slowly remove stuff that has gotten in your way?
Well, first of all, that's going to work different for different people. You know, it's like, for instance, you know, take prayer. Some people pray better than others. You know, they more surrender into it. You know, and the more surrendered you are, the more you attract something to, you know, to support that. And, you know, we're not therapists per se, although at a particular level of vortex healing, there's a transmission that brings in a higher level being that does therapy, literally therapy in the system. And you can see it working in the background of the psyche and things moving around and shifting. It's a very nice transmission. But for us, the reason why regular therapy is so slow is, well, two things. One is that as much as people want to get better, they don't really want to have to experience what they have to experience in order to get better. Mm-hmm. And then there's the things that they don't want to experience in themselves, which can be these big emotional charges, their identities that keep them stuck in, let's say, being a victim. And, you know, when there's a victim, there's a victimizer, and, you know, there's the self-protection and all of this stuff. It's hard to, it's hard through talk therapy to move through these supports, these energetic and consciousness supports that are sitting there in the system, supporting the issues, including blueprints. Here's an example. So I'd done all this work on, you know, my relationship with my mother, for instance, years ago. she's no longer alive. But when she had visited me and my wife at the time. And every time she'd walk into the room, you know, something in me would go, you know, just, you know, and I'd go back to my room and I'd meditate and I would think I would have cleared it. And, you know, and I was a very good meditator and I'd walk back into the room and there she'd be and then something would go, And after doing that a few times, I said, okay, there's got to be something that's holding that in place in spite of whatever I seem to be releasing. There's got to be something structural and energetic structural in some level that's holding it in place. And I sat down with Merle and I said, show me what this is. And he showed me that there are these blueprints that when we're born, every child that's born gets these blueprints for how to relate to each of their parents. Right? And so it's like, maybe you've had a bunch of past lives with them, or anyway, you come in with all these different aspects of personality, and there are all these different kinds of relationships you could have with that particular mother. But for whatever your path is for that life, the divine wants you to have a particular relationship. So it creates this blueprint, and consciousness sort of moves along it, and you start to relate from that place. And then the parent doesn't need to have a blueprint because it just responds to the way you're relating to it. You know, plus it has its own conditioning and so on. And so I found this blueprint that was holding me in a particular dynamic with my mother. And with Merlin's help, we broke it down and I walked into the room again. And that whole reaction pattern was now gone. Now, of course, if I hadn't done all the earlier work on it, it wouldn't have still been gone. The blueprint in itself wouldn't have taken care of it. But the blueprint was still just by itself holding this pattern in place. And suddenly I had this whole other appreciation for my mother as a being and, you know, what she had been through and, you know, all that kind of stuff, because I was no longer locked into, you know, relating to her out of that pattern. So imagine I'm trying to work through that just through talk therapy. Mm-hmm. You know, the odds are I never get to that blueprint. You know, I have to work around it. I have to compensate for it in some way. And try to create some new behavior to override the old behavior. But the basic blueprint for that behavior is still sitting there in the background.
Yeah, even if you could get to the blueprint, you wouldn't necessarily have a way of letting it go through the help of some divine being.
Oh, no, a divine being can help you to move that. I mean, it takes a deeper level of something to move a higher dimensional, because these blueprints are higher, sit on the higher dimensional levels of our consciousness.
Yeah, yeah. But in therapy, that unless you had that connection to the divine being, you it would stay there because there's nothing to let it go. Right. That's fascinating.
I want to make one other comment on Brian's last question.
Mm-hmm.
So, Advaita, you know, Neo Advaita talks about, you know, like there was no one there, and so there's no one that can do anything and so on. My response to that is that just because there's no one that can do anything doesn't mean that there's nothing that can be done. Which is a whole different way of looking at it. And the same with, even though there's nowhere to go, it doesn't mean that you don't have to walk. You know, it's a different take on, you know, what it means that there's no one inside. You know, there's still, you know, things that can happen that facilitate the unfolding and take you where that needs to go. There's still a path, even though, you know, the path is, you know, just the seemingness of a path.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of nothing to do and nowhere to go, I'm wondering if you can guide us in a meditation that will help us to get to where we don't need to go anywhere to get to.
Okay. Sure. Well, so we'll do a short meditation here. And so, anyone who's listening, just close your eyes for a moment, get centered, and just relax. Just sit with your breath for a few minutes, for a minute. Just sort of relax. And as you're relaxing, just get a sense of your normal, everyday sense of I am. Just that normal, everyday sense of I am, not trying to achieve anything here. We're just starting with where we are, with whatever sense of I am that you have. And that can be more on a body level, more on a mind level. It's going to be all of it together. It's just this, it's this basic sense that you are, that you exist. And as you do that, notice what happens if you imagine that you can take a filter around your experience and filter out the sense of I. So it's just am. Just filter out the sense of I that was originally there in the I am. So you're just sitting with the sense of am. And then we'll take that another step, which as you're sitting here with the sense of just am, filter the sense of am out of your experience. There's no I and there's no am. And that would drop you into just sort of this general sense of self. And then one more step is to filter the sense of self out of this experience. So there's no I, no am, no self. When you get lost, you just start very simply from the beginning. The sense of I am, take out the sense of I, filter out the sense of am, filter out the sense of self. And if you do that well enough, for a moment there's going to be like a, almost like a spark of something that isn't I am or self. And depending on how ripe one is, that spark can either grow or that spark is a sense of recognition as well of what you truly are beyond these layers of egoic identity. It's what you truly are, meeting yourself in form. And typically every time you have this moment of spark, if you will, or freedom, the mind immediately kicks and goes, what was that and how do I package it and how can I get back to it? What do I do with it? And it might spin out for a couple of minutes around that. That's okay. And then you just come back to the sense of I am. And you filter out the sense of I, so you're just sitting with am. And then you filter out the sense of am, which takes you into a general sense of self. And then again, you imagine you can filter out the sense of self and something else for just even perhaps the tiniest of moments makes itself known. That something else has no I, no am, no self, no mind, no consciousness, although it will reflect in your consciousness. But in itself, it has, it's not consciousness. And you can even breathe into that place, which helps kind of helps you to grow into it, so to speak, on a more organic level, on a body level. Some people, it can bring up fear, which is the ego being afraid of losing itself. Yeah. And that happens. You know, just recognize that as sort of weather going on in consciousness. That's just, it's not what you are. It's just this conditioning that's reacting to, you know, losing the sense of what thinks it is, even though that's not what you are. And if something comes up that just blocks you from going deeper, well, then you've at least met whatever your next issue is that you need to process in order to allow yourself to go deeper. Okay, so that was a simple, fairly simple meditation, but I find a very powerful one for people at all different levels of their path.
Yeah, I haven't ever heard a meditation like that. I found it incredibly valuable and surprisingly, you know, it's so simple yet very powerful very quickly. And for me, I got to a place of what I would call pure experience. How was that for you, Brian?
I thought it was lovely. And pure experience, that's a really good word for it because, well, I really couldn't come up with words. So thank you.
Pleasure.
Yeah. Well, this has been a great honor, Rick. I really appreciate you taking the time and all the work that you do. And if people want to find out more about your work, I guess the best place is to go to vortexhealing.org.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great.
Yep. And I just want to add that on the website, for anyone who wants to experience vortex healing, we have a button there called Find a Healer. And they can either find a healer in their area, or vortex healing works very well at a distance. And you can see what level of training a person has had. And so you can pick someone with, you know, the highest level of training, and no matter where they live, you can get a healing from them.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. And for our listeners, all our episodes are on awarenessexplorers.com and iTunes and Google Play. And you can, of course, tell your friends, neighbors, anybody you know about our stuff. Anything you want to add, Brian?
Well, just recently on our website, we have taken, for those who just want to listen to the meditation parts, I mean, I would recommend listening to the whole episode, but if later you want to come back and just listen to the meditations, we've separated them out and put them on a separate web page and also put them on YouTube so that if you'd like to just sit with the meditations and experience them over and over, you can do that now.
Nice.
I one friend said, I really like that you did that because that way I don't have to hear you blab. I can just go directly to the experience.
Yeah, sometimes it's good to skip the blather and go right to the experience. But Rick, thank you so much for joining us. It's so lovely to talk to you.
Thanks for inviting me.
And we'd like to tell our listeners, as always, keep exploring.
Keep exploring.
Thank you for listening to Awareness Explorers. To learn more, you can check out our website at awarenessexplorers.com. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or your favorite podcast app. And we'd love it if you would post a review. And please share our link on Facebook and with family and friends, because knowing yourself as awareness is the greatest gift you can give yourself or someone you love.